You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Remember malls? You know, those big structures with all kinds of stores in them? They'd usually be filled with people this time of year, shopping for costumes, early holiday shopping, perhaps. But for the last 7 months, they've been mostly closed due to COVID-19 until yesterday. Indoor shopping malls were allowed to reopen at a limited capacity, 25%, with plenty of hand sanitizing stations throughout those malls. But the food courts in the malls have to stay closed. Eddie Varela, who's co-owner of Pro Image Sports in the Westfield Culver City Mall, was relieved.
We've been closed down like half a year now, man. A little excited and nervous at the same time, man. Haven't done this for a while, so, you know, just waiting for you to see how everybody reacts to the mall being open. Hopefully we get some business.
KCRW's Angel Carreras went to a couple of malls in town to see how reopenings went, and he joins us right now. Hey, Angel.
Hi, Steve.
First of all, what was it even like in there? I mean, we're talking limited capacity, so I would imagine there weren't a whole lot of people in there.
Yeah, mostly correct. I mean, I went to the Beverly Center, and that was pretty empty, which I assume has to do with the price points. I mean, I don't know another mall with a Ferrari store. The Gucci and Louis Vuitton stores looked like they had some foot traffic, but it's mostly due to them being careful. Only a few people in at a time, everyone getting their temperature checked at the door. One person, a visiting Arizona State student who gave her first name as Lola, enjoyed the new emptiness of the mall.
You know, I just like it because people tend to get in my way at the mall. And there's no one here, so there's no one to, like, run into or anything. Love it.
But the Culver City Mall actually had a fair amount of people. There were window shoppers and the older person getting exercise in. But shoe stores, long lines at almost every one of them. All the sports shoes, all the places like Foot Locker and Chic and Foot Action. The lines formed outside those stores even before they opened. One sneakerhead, who told me his name was Kevin, said it's all about reselling those shoes online.
Shoes that are kind of available but not really, it just depends on the location. So other cities may not have it, or other states, so I'm grabbing it to probably sell to them.
So think rare shoes that were left behind when the pandemic closed the mall. That stock would still be sitting there, so he was out there early to grab them. By his own estimation, Kevin made out okay.
Nothing really hyped. Just, I mean, I think the best pair so far is Chicago Black Toe mid, and that's Jordan 1.
All right, so you have these folks going to malls, people standing in line to get some shoes. What was the mood among employees at the mall, Angel? I would imagine there's like this catch-22, right? I mean, you get to go back to work, but guess what? You might get this incurable virus.
Yeah, and from the people I talked to, there were some different trains of thought on that point. Here's Amelia Crawford, a 26-year-old shift leader at Miniso. That's a low-cost Chinese variety store, if you're unfamiliar. She was furloughed when the mall closed. I asked how she spent those past several months.
I'm a photographer on the side, and I write on the side, so, I mean, I did have that, but it's just, like, the unemployment part of it. It took 3 months to get through to it, so it's just kind of stuck, and then you're like, oh, how do I pay rent?
So she's glad to be back, keeping busy. She just doesn't want to experience another furlough.
I feel that we might just, like, close again, I guess. So that's, what, like, the only hesitation I have, because, like, the unemployment was just a horrible process. But, yeah, I mean, I'm excited to be back. It's something to do, keep me occupied.
And, of course, I asked if she was concerned about catching COVID being in a mall.
Not really. I mean, I'm pretty safe with, like, procedure and everything. Obviously, it's in the back of the mind, but if you get it, you get it. It's kind of, you can't really stress about it too much, I would say. I don't, at least, so.
So, Angel, I suspect, all right, she's not really concerned, but there are people who probably are concerned about their health, right, given the situation.
Yes, and here's Adeline Ramirez, a 30-year-old greeter at Old Navy. She's worried about closures, too, but her health, yeah. And she's a greeter, so her job is to be around people, say hi during a pandemic. I asked how she was feeling about that.
Overwhelmed, and especially greeter, because you're like the first person the people pass by, so it's kind of like, you know? Yeah. But yeah, mainly it's just overwhelming. Mainly like customers, you know, like getting up too close, stuff like that, like, yeah.
I suspect, yeah, that worries quite a few folks. I gotta ask you, Angel, I mean, how are business owners doing? I mean, not everything in a mall is a big chain of stores that can weather a pandemic. We've seen this going on for months and months. How are the little guys, the small businesses doing?
Well, it's been rough for business owners. Take Pro Image Sports, a mom and pop sporting goods store, whose co-owner, Eddie Varela, you heard from earlier. His business partner, Ricardo Velasquez, says Pro Image Sports slipped into six figures of debt trying to keep their business alive.
This whole 2020 and COVID thing has just been horrible, and it's been a strain mentally for both of us, man. And it's definitely going to be, now that we're open, we thank God and we're definitely appreciative, but it's definitely an uphill battle from here.
So they're hoping the confluence of the mall's reopening and LA sports teams doing well will bring back some much needed foot traffic. That'll maybe lead to, who knows, sold out LeBron, Justin Turner jerseys, Laker hats, mugs, all that jazz.
We're glad that we're open now that the Lakers are going to win the finals for sure. So we're excited about that. The Dodgers are on the right track as well. And so if both the Lakers and the Dodgers win their respective championships, then it's going to be good for us for sure.
Let's keep our fingers crossed on both those fronts. And obviously fingers crossed for all those people at the shopping mall. Everybody there, the small and big businesses and the people going into those malls. KCRW's Angel Carreras reporting on reopening of malls in LA County. Angel, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Now, you know, in these sobering times, of course, the way you get your information is important, whether it be about malls, indoor malls that are reopening slowly across greater LA, whether it be about the coronavirus itself and how cases have been on sort of a roller coaster ride. We've been on the decline a little bit the past few weeks, and that's good news. We'll see how that goes. But that information is important to you, and if you use this service on KCRW, how about throwing a few bones to us? KCRW.com/give. Alongside the national reporting you hear from NPR, KCRW brings you the local news that drives your everyday. Updates on not only the coronavirus, but fires, protests, community relief, all of that you get from KCRW and the information on shows such as Greater LA or Press Play or Mornings with Cherry Glazer right here on KCRW. Again, KCRW.com/give. Thank you so much for your support. Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you've lived in Los Angeles for more than 20 years, you'll remember downtown before it became DTLA. It was nothing more than a business center. It turned into a ghost town after 5 o'clock. But in 1999, something happened. The city council passed something called the Adaptive Reuse Ordinance, which created incentives for developers to build out residential units in old, historic, and abandoned buildings. People started to move to downtown LA, and in the two decades since, it's become a vibrant urban center, a neighborhood with clubs, bars, and restaurants. And then came COVID, and then came protests, adding to an already chronic homeless crisis. Restaurants in DTLA are now hurting badly, if they're even able to survive at all. Our regular contributor, Mona Holmes, reports for Eater LA, and she's here right now to talk about it. Hey, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
Before the pandemic hit, I know DTLA was almost, you know, was becoming like a little mini Manhattan, although don't say that to New Yorkers because they don't see the comparison at all. But more and more people were moving there, though, to downtown. Tourists were out and the dining and cocktail scene was on the up. When you go there now, what's it like?
Well, it's a little, I actually drove downtown to pick up some food just yesterday. And it's very sleepy. I drove down during a time when it should be just like super busy. And it does remind me of a time long in the past about downtown LA. As soon as 5 p.m. hit, as you described, it became very quiet. I know a great many people who live in downtown, and of course they're still there, but it's quiet because the tourists are missing, you know, and of course office workers were also missing. So there's a huge missing element of downtown that's very much a part of downtown.
Restaurants, Mona, in LA were hit, obviously, with this whiplash effect going back to this past spring, right, when COVID arrived and we had this problem and restaurants had to shut down. And then, you know, the whiplash comes because they were shut down and then they were reopened. for a little while. And then, you know, there was a spike in cases again over the summer. The governor shut those restaurants back down. What was that like, do you think, for some of the restaurant owners that you spoke to?
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the back and forth. It's whiplash is definitely the best way to describe this unfortunate feeling. I spoke with the owner of Takami Sushi and 71 Above. His name is Emil Ivazov. And he was really careful about reopening because he noticed some of his other restaurant owner colleagues, you know, really struggling with the back and forth, with the notifications from the health department, from the governor to the mayor. And one thing that really struck me was when LA County's public health director announced that it was safe for dining rooms to reopen on May 29th. She announced it the day of. So restaurant owners were scrambling to reopen their dining rooms, making sure that they had enough staff, making sure that they had enough food, and then only to hear that everything was closed again. Business owners like him were forced to eat the cost of foodstuffs, the money that they paid out to employees, you know, and there was also another element that he mentioned, that he didn't want to take people off of unemployment to come back only to close again.
And it wasn't just COVID, Mona, because, you know, we all witnessed on Memorial Day the horrific death of George Floyd in Minneapolis under the knee of a police officer. And then protests ensued after that. And you had downtown L.A., you know, sort of at the thrust of the spotlight again. There were a lot of protests in downtown L.A. Were restaurants thrown into the middle of those protests?
Yes, unfortunately. I mean, downtown LA is always a spot for protests or activity, no matter what's going on. There's still protests happening now. But the timing of this is what's key here. The public health director, Dr. Barbara Ferrer, announced that restaurant dining rooms could reopen. Restaurants scrambled, but people were on the street. People were marching. So restaurants quickly prepared to accept customers, but then had to close again. And not just because people were marching, but because there was this haphazard announcements that were coming from the city about curfews that were coming through. So, you know, at one point, I believe it was 5 o'clock and then 6 o'clock the next day. And so it was impossible for anyone, including a restaurant owner, to make any plans. And one restaurant that strikes me as being really in the thick of it was Petit Peso, this wonderful Filipino restaurant in downtown, and also had a burning police car in front of their restaurant, and were figuring out how to board up their windows and do anything to make sure that their businesses were intact, while at the same time respecting that people were exercising their First Amendment rights.
And here we are, you know, October 8th, and we're trying to, you know, figure it out as we go. The city created a few months back an alfresco program where you can eat outside, right? Or maybe there's a parklet or outside on the sidewalk. You've got that going on. Is that working in downtown LA?
You know, it's. I love the alfresco dining program. I think it was one of Garcetti's better solutions, and a ton of restaurants throughout the city have been able to take advantage, except in downtown, because the things that make it successful are having ample sidewalk space or parking lots, and the majority of downtown restaurants don't have either. And also, too, there's another element that a couple of restaurant owners also shared with me, is that the homelessness issue in downtown with the unhoused residents makes it very challenging to take advantage of that program. One consultant that I spoke with said that it's just impossible. One of his clients is only a block away from Skid Row. And so having people sitting outside on the parking lot, it's just not realistic for them to be able to navigate that.
All right. So let's think of something more positive, like what will it take to get places back? What are the bright spots, do you think, in the future?
I do believe that the community needs to come together in a way that they did back in the mid-2000s to, you know, with some advocacy and, you know, the things that wound up making downtown downtown. And it's unfortunate that they haven't really been able to do that because they're just dealing with operating from day to day. I wish I had more optimism to throw your way, but it's pretty desperate.
it's going to be a challenge to see them come back, and it's going to be a challenge to see how downtown is completely transformed after all of this is hopefully over soon.
Our regular contributor, Mona Holmes from Eater LA. Mona, thanks for the update.
Thanks for having me.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. So let's end the show today by getting all liquored up. No, I'm not encouraging you to get hammered. I'm talking about the actual collection and novelty of the booze itself. Maybe an old, a very old, dusty bottle of sherry, part of Hollywood lore, a 118-year-old bottle recently discovered in a cellar in the San Fernando Valley. Turns out that bottle was from Hollywood heavyweight Cecil B. DeMille. Yeah, you know that guy, Cecil B. DeMille, the I'm ready for my close-up guy, who apparently had quite the penchant for the fancy, spirited bottle. For more on this recent revelation, we're joined by Caroline Debonet, who's a wine importer and distributor. She certainly knows the value of this stuff. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, Steve.
Wow, 118-year-old sherry. You don't open that bottle, right? You're not gonna pour that into a glass.
I'm not. Well, even if I wanted to, I couldn't have, because that bottle in particular was empty.
It was empty.
So, yeah. But it was probably the crème de la crème, as we would say, the prize of the prize in that collection of wine and spirits that I had the fortune of looking over and reviewing and assessing from Mr. DeMille. It was an empty bottle of sherry dating back to 1902 at the occasion of Mr. DeMille's marriage to his wife, Constance. And it was an empty bottle that I had found on day one of my discovery up in his cellar, where there was a mailing label outlined in red, you know, those old-fashioned mailing labels that you'd affix to an oversized yellow envelope. And it was in his handwriting, simply stating that this was a bottle purchased in New York City at the occasion of my wedding to Constance in 1902, and it was to have been opened at the occasion of the marriage of their firstborn. So that bottle was indeed empty when I found it, but truly became the certificate of authenticity to the whole collection.
Well, how do you do that, by the way? I mean, take us through the authentication process, because, you know, this is a bottle of booze, and you might know what kind it is and when it was made and all of that, but how do you know it's Cecil B. DeMille's?
Well, you have to go a few steps back here. So Cecil B. DeMille had a ranch called Paradise Ranch that he had acquired in the area of Lakeview Terrace in 1916. It has since, after his death, it had been donated to an orphanage and then essentially sold to private owners, the last of whom had approached me one day. Middle Ranch is an equine facility where I have been riding my horse for several years now. And I had been approached by the owner one day as I was riding my horse on the property, and he called out to me and said, "Hey, aren't you the wine girl?" And I looked at him and said, "Yeah, that's me." And he essentially explained to me that there are several private residences on the property. And his in particular, there was a basement under the property full of old, dusty bottles of wine and spirits. And not being very familiar or into booze themselves, they were doing some remodeling and essentially wanted that basement cleared out, and had asked me if I wouldn't mind going up there and taking a look at what was in the cellar to understand what exactly they had on hand. And as I'm going through the process of unwrapping, unfortunately, all the work they had done to individually wrap every single bottle in bubble wrap, I had to undo, or else I couldn't do my job. And it was like Christmas. Every single bottle, there was such an intimacy to the process. I don't know how to say it. It was like delving into...
No, you're unwrapping everything like a present, right? Like, oh my God,
exactly.
What is this going to be? What is... Yeah.
Yep, that's exactly right. And took the time. It was painstakingly slow. And I won't deny that I kind of let my imagination wander a little bit, because I would wonder, I could just imagine those evenings, those soirees that Mr. DeMille would host with his fellow writer, director friends, and a few lady friends probably. And as I'd open about, oh, this is probably for the guys, and these bottles were for the ladies. But each bottle had to be examined under light to determine clarity, fill, the amount of alcohol or liquid still in the bottle, and corrosion, intact tax seals. I mean, it's a long, complicated process. And to add to that, the fragility of the labels, because some of these labels, we're talking over 100 years old, so they're brittle, they're fragile. And I knew very well, though, that label had a value in and of itself.
So you find all this booze. Some of the bottles are empty, like the sherry, which I don't know what you do with that, right? Do you put a candle in that? What do you do with an empty bottle of sherry?
Well, I set it aside. I knew this was, okay, this is prize thing. I set that one aside. And as I'm going through the process, there were about 200 to 250 bottles in total. A good part of them were empty. Most of the wine bottles were empty. There was a lot of German wine. He was also clearly a fan of bubbly. There was, I don't know, a dozen or so bottles of 1929 Veuve Clicquot champagne. And I ended up with perhaps 45, 50 bottles of spirits, most of them being whiskeys, of a mixture of different whiskeys and bourbon and rye whiskeys.
All of this, I mean, what eventually happened, Caroline, with the DeMille collection?
So once I had assessed what I considered the prize collection, I reached out to a friend and colleague of mine who is also in the business and is an expert in spirits. And he suggested, look, you can go two routes. You can go and approach the auction houses in New York, or you can go to the local private collector. And given the pandemic that we're all living through, given that we were at the height of summer, so shipping, logistics, I don't like shipping any alcohol when it's 100 degrees, and that there's no live auctions right now. So I opted to go the local private collector route. So my friend decided, well, he helped me identify a few collectors that he thought might be interested in the collection. And what surprised me, though, was each one of these collectors, it was clear they were experts, and this was their passion. I mean, they would come down and look at the cellar. First of all, I also showed that empty bottle of sherry because I was like, there is no question this is legit. Yeah. And what fascinated me, though, was the amount of money these people were willing to pay, not to resell or even try to make a profit on it, given the nostalgia of this being a DeMille collection, but for their own private enjoyment. And the rest is history. The one who outbid them all is the one who walked away with the collection. And after pleading with me to get that empty bottle of sherry that was signed, I eventually relinquished to the person who got the collection, rightfully so.
What did it go for, by the way?
Oh, I'm not at liberty to say. In the five figures.
So tens of thousands of dollars.
Yes.
Wow. Did he buy all of the bottles from the DeMille collection?
He did not. What I had set aside was actually the collection of spirits. There were also a handful of wines that I also know will have value. One of them being a 1947 Chateau Aubryon, of course, a Bordeaux first growth. There's a 1945 Chateau d'Yquem, which is a dessert wine. And both of those extraordinary vintages and bottles in pretty decent condition. So anyone out there interested, you know, they are still there and have yet to be offered officially. So,
well, it is Thirsty Thursday, Caroline. Caroline Debonnet, wine importer, distributor for Caroline Debonnet Selections. Caroline, congratulations. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
A bottle of red, a bottle of white. It all depends upon your appetite. I'll meet you anytime you want in our Italian restaurant.
Oh, Brenda and Eddie. Popular steady. In these sobering times, how do you keep your spirits up, by the way? Of course, the way you get your information is important. Stories like that you just heard on Greater LA these days can all feel the same, but you can add a spark of joy to your life, well, by a story like that, or by giving to the radio station. One simple act that you can take for the greater good, which is giving to KCRW at kcrw.com/give. On our shows, at this place, you get insights on local ballot measures to help you make sense of it all. We've got an election coming up. We've already talked about several of the propositions, including 15 and 16 in recent weeks. Next week, we're set to cover Prop 22. KCRW.com/give is the address. It's an important thing to do. If you use the radio station for its services, the things that we tell you each and every day, truth in reporting, that's so important, especially now. Give to the radio station if you can. If you can't, it's okay. We ask your friends and neighbors to do it. Pick up the slack, kcrw.com/give. And thank you so much for your support of public radio. Next week, I mentioned Prop 22. We'll be talking about that. Plus, it's happening a world away, how the Armenian-Azerbaijani conflict is stirring up big emotions here in Greater LA. That's next week on this program. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Mario Diaz, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl all made this show happen this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears and your attention. Have yourself a great night.